when we last left Enterprise, she'd finally been granted her first significant respite of the war after just over a year of near-constant action. However, the news was bittersweet, as instead of stopping off in Pearl Harbor to decant Air Group 10 and then heading over for California, they'd been told they had to remain in Hawaii for 6 weeks to help train up a new air group. As a result, the ship spent the late spring and the first half of summer of 1943 at Pearl Harbor, the 6 weeks stretching to 10. Carrier Air Group 10, with its aircraft now ashore, was gradually shifting its composition as veteran pilots were recalled home to train new flyers, lead their own squadrons, or be promoted up to join some officer or other's air staff. Those who remained, while somewhat newer to the war generally, had still seen several significant actions, and these would become the core of the new version of Carrier Air Group 10, which would eventually be made ready to deploy with one or the other of the US Navy's growing fleet of carriers, whichever was ready for them first. And speaking of new carriers, a new vessel had appeared in Pearl Harbor during Enterprise's stay. It was the shape of things to come, as it was the newly commissioned USS Essex. That, of course, immediately led to a bar brawl of epic proportions that reportedly started when someone from the new ship suggested that, since it was clearly the bigger and more powerful vessel, it should now take on the moniker of Big E, which the battle-hardened crew of the Enterprise took considerable exception to. But in happier news, Enterprise became the first US carrier to receive a presidential unit citation. But the ship wasn't spending its entire time tied up next to a pier. Although still battered, she was helping to bring the new Carrier Air Group 12, destined to head out aboard USS Saratoga, up to speed. The F-12 was particularly notable in that it was operating a brand new fighter, the F-4U Corsair, which was causing no end of trouble as pilots tried to work out how to land the thing when they couldn't see past the gigantic engine. But finally, on the 14th of July 1943, Enterprise was released to return to the continental United States. Although she was no longer heading for California, her destination was instead now Bremerton in Washington State, with Carrier Air Group 10 along for the ride, arriving 6 days later in a blanket of fog which saw the ship navigate in entirely based on radar and radio direction finding beacons at a near crawl of 10 knots, while blasting the horn every couple of minutes to tell other ships to get out the way. Happily, though, in the dawn's early light, the fog gradually burned away, and for the first time in what seemed like far too long, the sailors were able to look at something other than open sea or tropical islands, as the wooded hills and mountains of the area around Bremerton and Puget Sound rose out of the mist as the fog gradually dissipated. For Enterprise herself, it was the first time she'd dropped anchor in a mainland US port since September 1939. The ship was now due for just over 3 months in the care of the yard, and the ship's executive officer had carefully taken a list of all the officers and men who wanted to head home to their families for a bit and divided them up into 3 groups, each of which was issued with a 30-day leave pass. At 10:30 on the evening of the 20th of July, the first group of 680 crew boarded the ship's launches and once ashore began spreading out across the country, heading back to various friends and family. One particularly enterprising young officer had a family, including a son who'd been born while he was at sea, based all the way over in New England, and he decided he wasn't going to waste a good portion of his leave on slow trains gradually travelling across the entirety of the continent, and instead he headed for the nearest airbase, and proceeded to persuade a series of transport aircraft pilots to give him a ride, traversing the country in a little under 2 days on a rather zigzag course, although he noted that the last 40 miles ended up costing him far more than the preceding 2,500, as he was forced to find a late-night taxi to cover the distance from the nearest airbase to his family home. Back at Bremerton, though, there was still a lot of work to be done. For those not on leave, or not yet having received their 30-day pass, they had liberty to go into town or over to Seattle if they could find transport, and the ship's gunners were sent off for a week of training in new anti-aircraft techniques and equipment, which was a harbinger of some of the changes that were about to be made to their ship. On the 21st, Enterprise was ordered to begin unloading her magazines prior to entering dry dock. The job turned out to be a grueling one, not finishing until 0200 on the 22nd, as around 3,700 5-inch shells, their accompanying charges, 3 dozen torpedoes, 6 dozen large bombs, 62 depth charges, almost 1,750 cases of 40mm ammunition, and a seemingly endless tide of 20mm, all was hauled out of the ship and then sent ashore on barges. 18 hours after the last ammunition barge had left, the ship was settling on the blocks in Number 5 dry dock. Spotting a row of small wooden houses across the inlet from the ship, the XO arranged for the US Navy to take temporary ownership of them, allowing the remaining crew to have somewhere to sleep ashore while the ship was largely unpowered and out of the water, while also providing some space for families who'd come up to Bremerton to visit their sons, husbands, or fathers as applicable. About the only disadvantage of this particular situation was that everybody quickly had to develop an intimate knowledge of the ferry schedule across the bay, or risk finding themselves on the wrong side of an almost 120-mile road trip around the bay. A number of men who missed the last ferry back to their accommodation elected to just hang around in bars for the entire night. It was a little more difficult if you missed the morning ferries, though, since the crew were still required to be aboard the ship during the day. If they were interested during their liberty period, the men could also go and take a look at the ongoing work that was taking place to modernise and to a certain extent rebuild the battleships California and West Virginia, which were still at Bremerton, still being made good from the damage they'd incurred on December 7th, 1941. Meanwhile, their own ship was having a scarcely less thorough treatment, as workers in the Navy Yard began stripping away systems and equipment, in some cases for refurbishment or relocation, and in others for outright replacement. Then the various layers of accreted battle damage and associated repairs came under scrutiny. Some of the work was good enough to remain, but a huge amount had been temporarily patched, jury-rigged, or only really put in to address the major issues of the damage, and so all of this was torn out so that more permanent repairs could be put in place. With the displacement restrictions of the London Naval Treaty well behind them, 2 new large bulges could be installed, one on either side of the ship, which expanded the vessel's torpedo defence system from being mostly prayer-based to include the ability to actually stop at least smaller torpedo explosions from significantly rupturing the internals of the ship. Tanks for additional fuel were also included to extend the ship's own range and, by increasing the overall fuel capacity on board, also helping to boost the amount available for the air group. Inside the island, 3 smaller rooms were combined into a single larger combat information centre, or CIC. Additional powerful diesel-fueled water pumps were brought in, which could provide either firefighting water or dewatering capabilities, either available in the event of localised or total power loss, or they could just help out with the regular pumps as long as local power was maintained. New accommodation and food storage areas were constructed, and a cavalcade of new anti-aircraft weapons showed up on convoys of trucks. Although her heavy anti-aircraft battery would remain 8 single 5-inch .38 caliber guns, the existing guns were removed and then replaced by newer improved models with new directors, training and elevating equipment. 22 or 24 new 40mm Bofors were installed to supplement those which were already on the ship, with 2 additional quad mounts and either 7 or 8 twin mounts newly arriving, depending on your source. Additional 20mm Oerlikons also arrived on board, of course, it was World War II USA, and new radar guidance director units were fitted, which allowed the 40mm battery to be operated in conditions of poor visibility or darkness. A similar system had arrived with the new 5-inch guns to allow them the same capability. Several new radars appeared above the island, although the old ones were also kept in place as backups, with many hoping that this combination of changes would finally allow the 5-inch battery to live up to its on-paper performance statistics. Hard-won war lessons were also being implemented internally. The fire main system was significantly extended and given massive redundancy in the form of additional valves, connection points, and loops. The magazine flooding system was replaced by a sprinkler system that was also connected to the various additional ammunition storage rooms that had been created since the ship was commissioned. The sound-powered telephone network and power bypass systems were likewise expanded and given additional redundancy, with environmental conditions aboard also being improved, as heating, ventilation, and air conditioning ducts were all expanded to cover a variety of new areas. From the air group's perspective, there were also significant changes. The arresting cable system was taken out and thoroughly overhauled before being replaced. The catapults were removed and replaced with newer and more powerful ones. And the flight deck itself was made longer and wider, all of which would allow the support of newer, larger, and heavier aircraft that were then being developed or deployed. Also important to morale was the arrival of more and improved ice cream makers, which were duly installed in the galley. At the end of September, the ship's much-beloved XO, John Crommelin, received a promotion to captain, which meant a new assignment. He would go on to command a series of escort carriers. As the new XO bedded in, less than 20 miles away, Carrier Air Group 10 was also continuing its process of reforming. While the Dauntlesses and Avengers appeared to be notionally the same, they were being replaced with updated models, but they were still going by the same overall title, there were also some more visually obvious upgrades, such as some of the Avengers being given air-to-surface radar, and the largest change was VF-10's Wildcats being traded in wholesale for the brand new F-6F Hellcat. The second tranche of men, given 30-day leave, left on the 20th of August, and the third left on the 20th of September. And then on the 25th of September, the dry dock was flooded, and Enterprise was moved back out to Pier 5, where work would continue while the dry dock was made available for another ship. She would then be moved into dry dock 4 on the 19th of October, but this time the dry dock wasn't drained. Instead, it was used as a controlled environment where large weights were placed on the flight deck and then moved around so that the ship's stability could be checked against the calculations that had been made. She had, after all, gained several thousand tons of additional weight, somewhat offset by the bulges, so it was important to ensure that the ship wasn't now dangerously top-heavy. With the crew back aboard, Enterprise headed out for sea on the 24th of October for trials. But despite the massive overhaul changing quite a bit about the vessel, it turned out there was very little to adjust. After a couple of days of working up, she was back alongside the pier for 5 days. During this time, there would be some minor remedial work, but the bulk of the activity was bringing aboard the tons and tons of stores and supplies that were needed for the ship to deploy. It was time to head out to action once more, and as October turned into November, the ship was powering out to sea while the newly reformed Carrier Air Group 10 landed aboard her, and course was set for Hawaii. But less than 5 days later, there was still more change. As the ship reached Hawaii, Captain Ginder was being promoted to command of Task Group 58.4, while Captain Gardner took over command of Enterprise. Additionally, Carrier Air Group 10, having only been aboard for less than a week, was flown off to Hawaii for further advanced training, and its place was taken by Carrier Air Group 6, the pilots being the heirs to the formation that had, of course, originally deployed with Enterprise, with this air group under the command of Lieutenant Commander Butch O'Hare. Although, interestingly, while the VB and VT units were VB6 and VT6, the fighter squadron was VF2. With many new pilots in Carrier Air Group 6 and around 40% of Enterprise's crew also new to the ship after various reassignments and the stay in Bremerton, it was a learning experience for all concerned as the ship worked up and headed out as part of Task Group 50.2. For veterans of the ship's earlier battles, there was also a little bit of an eerie sight, as by this point near the end of 1943, still more Essex-class had arrived at Pearl Harbor, including two ships that were named for vessels Enterprise had served alongside and in one case witnessed sink. These new vessels, of course, being the Lexington and the Yorktown. As part of Fifth Fleet, Enterprise was once again under the overall auspices of Admiral Spruance, with the fleet bound for a mission to retake the Gilbert Islands, which consisted of three primary atoll sections, Makin, Tarawa, and Apimama. The first two being the primary targets as the third was practically undefended. Enterprise's task group consisted of herself and the Independence-class light carriers Belleau Wood and Monterey, plus escorts in the shape of half a dozen destroyers and no less than three fast battleships, the North Carolina, the Indiana, and the Massachusetts. Their task was to secure the air over Macon, then attack enemy positions, support the landings, and stand by in case the Imperial Japanese Navy sought to contest their operations. At 0540 on the 19th of November, 33 aircraft, a mix of Dauntlesses and Hellcats, headed skyward as the first of 15 scheduled airstrikes for the day. This initial attack took the defenders of Macon entirely by surprise, and no air opposition was encountered. Indeed, the only resistance at all came from a single large anti-aircraft gun that opened up fruitlessly at the strike as it departed, its sheer size and calibre perhaps better used for engaging flying boats or long-distance bombers. Throughout the day, the story was much the same. A single Japanese fighter appeared and was immediately swarmed by Hellcats. A few anti-aircraft guns opened up, but they were quickly suppressed as well. The next day, as the landings themselves went in, Carrier Air Group 6 joined with the surface vessels in dropping vast amounts of explosive on the defending trench lines and emplacements in order to facilitate the landings. One crew had a far more passive but also very important role. VT-6's commander, Lieutenant Commander Phillips, took to the skies in an Avenger that carried no weapons apart from its guns. The Bombay was instead loaded with extra fuel. His mission was to circle Macon slowly for most of the day, spotting enemy activity far below and radioing anything particularly important down to USS Pennsylvania, aboard which was Admiral Turner, who would then make any needed changes to the stream of troops and equipment being sent ashore. Although small arms fire from the defenders continued, something the orbiting Avenger couldn't spot, the avalanche of explosive from the US Navy seemed to have largely subdued any defences of heavier calibre than rifles and machine guns, which the Japanese defenders might otherwise have been able to bring to bear. The most interesting things the Avenger reported during the morning was the occasional burst of fire from lone anti-aircraft guns, although one of them did manage to wing a machine gun bullet into the Avenger's fuel line. The aircraft noticed the leak, was landed aboard Enterprise, a replacement secured, and then observation continued through much of the afternoon. At least that is until another lucky anti-aircraft gun, this time firing an explosive shell, managed to sever the elevator cable of this new aircraft with a fragment of shrapnel. Although initially thinking they'd have to crash land on the most secure of the target beaches, with some ingenuity the crew spliced the severed cable back together, while Phillips kept up his reports of what was going on down below, until just before 1700 that afternoon when the Avenger managed a textbook landing back aboard Enterprise, which had cleared her decks just in case the spliced cable gave way and sent the Avenger crashing to the deck. In fact, compared to the numerous fraught and costly actions of 1942, that day proved relatively easy for the ship, with 135 takeoffs being accompanied by 137 landings. The discrepancy being due to the fact that one of the Dauntlesses ended up developing engine issues which caused it to ditch nearby with its crew recovered, but three fighters from Belleau Wood ended up landing on Enterprise instead. Whether they got lost or whether Belleau Wood was busy at the time is unclear, but nonetheless, the Enterprise ended the day with a net gain of two aircraft. The following day, there was so little Japanese resistance of a scope that was large enough to summon a scheduled airstrike that Carrier Air Group 6's aircraft ended up circling, waiting to be called in to specific point targets by troops on the ground. A few half-submerged hulks offshore proved more interesting. Holdout parties of Japanese troops had now appeared and were shooting at the boat traffic from these positions, and so a productive afternoon was spent experimenting with the best way to get bombs onto these targets. It turned out that the best technique for suppressing them was actually just to have a flight of Hellcats dive in on the given hulk and empty their 50 caliber machine guns into it. With that task accomplished, Enterprise went into standby mode, with aircraft ready on deck for on-call support, as well as being spotted just in case the Imperial Japanese Navy showed up, but with no further active combat flights scheduled This was in sharp contrast to operations further along the island chain in Tarawa, which was still being fought over for every last yard. But the risk to the now locked-in amphibious forces off of Makin in the event the Japanese did decide to sail meant that Enterprise and her two smaller carrier companions could not be called away to help efforts on Tarawa. That wasn't to say that the following days were calm. Although slow to react, the Japanese began to probe US defences with long-range recon flights. The escort carrier Liscombe Bay was sunk with over 700 of her crew when I-175 got close enough to launch a torpedo strike at her just south of Makin. And then, on the night of the 25th, a Japanese aerial strike force arrived by night. A dozen Hellcats were launched and vectored on an intercept course by radar, but although this attack was mostly deterred by radar-directed anti-aircraft fire, it did manage to launch flares over the US forces, and so they knew things were only likely to escalate. And so it proved on the night of the 26th when a large number of Japanese torpedo bombers appeared. But although night flying was, even in late 1943, very much in its infancy in the US Navy, Enterprise was fortunate to have some very innovative pilots aboard. Having concluded that a radar-equipped Avenger could probably be guided into range of its own radar by the radar operators aboard Enterprise, Lieutenant Commander Phillips and Butch O'Hare had decided to solve the next issue, which was the fact that the Avenger was many things but a swift night fighter was not one of them, by concluding that if said Avenger was accompanied by a couple of Hellcats, then the Avenger could get all three of them into visual range, and then the fighters could take over. Thus, that night, Phillips took off in his Avenger, although he was following O'Hare and his wingman, who'd left some minutes earlier. Initially, the Japanese aircraft proved somewhat elusive, and the Hellcats were initially trying to search based purely on directions from Enterprise, to no avail. But eventually, the Avenger managed to lock onto a contact, and the two Hellcats were guided to Phillips by the Enterprise's radar officer. However, the Avenger closed in on its target before the Hellcats could arrive, and so Phillips opened up with his two forward machine guns before hauling up alongside the Japanese twin-engine bomber to let his turret gunner broadside it. The enemy bomber fell away in flames as scattered panic fire ahead betrayed the position of other enemy bombers. The Hellcats used the fireball as an additional vector to help them catch up with the Avenger. Phillips then closed in on and dispatched another bomber before the Hellcats could meet up with him, and the three aircraft then pulled into formation, switching on basic navigation lights so they could see each other more clearly and to avoid friendly fire. But then tragedy struck. A.B. Kernan, the Avenger's tail gunner, spotted an unlit aircraft stalking slightly behind and off to one side of O'Hare's aircraft and opened fire. It seems that the Japanese aircraft returned fire on one of the US aircraft as sometime after the Avengers ceased firing, a matter of 10 seconds or so, something clearly happened to Butch O'Hare's aircraft, and it slid out of formation before plunging into the sea with nary a word. Although a search was organised the following morning, no trace of the aircraft was ever found. It seemed that although only two Japanese aircraft had been shot down by the efforts, these actions had disconcerted the rest of them, and although the occasional flare was dropped, no major attack developed, despite the number of aircraft that were out there on Enterprise's radar screens. As November closed out, and it became increasingly obvious that no Japanese Navy surface force was coming, and the US hold on Makin was being consolidated, Enterprise and the rest of the formation were given leave to move to seaward, and any subsequent Japanese attempts to find them, if any were launched, failed completely. But a week later, the ships were summoned to hit Kwajalein in the Marshall Islands. For some veterans aboard Enterprise, this was something of a sort of homecoming, as almost 2 years ago, Enterprise had come up against exactly the same island, although at that point she'd been alone, taking part in the first US offensive strike of the war. Back then, the strikes had been made up of small groups of Wildcats and Devastators, but now 56 aircraft, a mixture of Hellcats, Avengers and Dauntlesses, roared off her flight deck, with three of the new Essex class, Essex, Yorktown and Lexington, launching their own strikes at the same time nearby, while Belau Wood provided a combat air patrol. Carrier Air Group 6 was tasked with the southern end of the main island. On their way, they passed ongoing strikes from the other carriers on closer targets, and once on station, the first thing they spotted was a seaplane base, which was duly attacked by a dozen Hellcats and repeated strafing runs that left over a dozen enemy seaplanes sinking, on fire, or badly shot up. Then the bomb-armed Dauntlesses and Avengers were summoned against a concentration of enemy shipping that had been spotted in the main anchorage. The shallow water meant the Avengers were carrying four 500-pound bombs each, as opposed to a torpedo, which might strike the seabed and break up. With multiple ships hit and some already sinking, a quartet of aircraft, two Avengers and two Dauntlesses, all loaded up with cameras, began taking pains to photograph both the damage done in the attack, as well as the island group in general, all with a view to facilitating a landing in the near future. A handful of Japanese aircraft made a belated appearance, but most were simply quickly added to the Japanese Navy's casualty lists by the Hellcats, and the entire strike group made it back unscathed, although on the return leg one of the F-6Fs ran out of fuel and had to ditch near the destroyer USS Kidd, which picked him up. The carriers then started to head back out to sea. Follow-up attacks in the afternoon had been called off, despite some pilots' protests that a number of Japanese aircraft were still sitting untouched on various airfields. As it turned out, their warnings proved somewhat prophetic. A quartet of Kates came in at wavetop height, gunning for the Yorktown, and only frantic last-minute anti-aircraft barrages saved the ship, which was still very nearly hit. But that attack, in the early afternoon, was just a harbinger of things to come. Around sunset, the first radar contacts appeared, beginning to circle the US formations. These were clearly keeping an eye on them, helped by a bright moon and clear skies, while more and more Japanese aircraft arrived. Small groups of these aircraft would then break off from the circling numbers and begin their attack runs. Just before midnight, Lexington, in her separate task group, was hit and was temporarily left circling as her rudder jammed thanks to the Japanese torpedo. But, back on Enterprise, the ship remained locked down, completely unlit and with guns tracking but not firing. Instead, the incoming attackers were monitored on radar, and when they began their attack run, usually accompanied by the dropping of flares, Admiral Radford would order his ships to change course and speed radically, slipping away into the darkness once again and leaving the enemy bombers to make attack runs on well-illuminated patches of empty ocean. This dance back and forth continued for 6 hours until, at about 1:30 in the morning, the moon set and the remaining enemy aircraft, unable to see much at all, withdrew. A few more waves of enemy bombers would be spotted over the next few days, but to little effect, as they in turn failed to spot Enterprise. With that, the ship turned back for Pearl Harbor. Another mission had been successfully accomplished, and the crew now had the promise of this being their first Christmas spent on US soil, as December 25, 1941 had passed when they were on patrol near Midway, and 1942 had found them repairing the ship at Espiritu Santo. This time, at least, there would be plenty of food, drink, and, for those who wanted it, company. Once in harbour, it became known that Carrier Air Group 6 was due to depart, as they'd been assigned to USS Intrepid, yet another of the new Essex class, while Carrier Air Group 10, having spent the last 3 months training relentlessly in the skies over Hawaii, would be rejoining the ship when she set out again in 1944 for her next assignment.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.